When Ender had visited with Planter, he had been surrounded with medical equipment, lying on a bed. It was different now inside the isolation chamber. Glass was in perfect health, and though he was wired up to all the monitoring devices, he was not bedbound. Playful and happy, he could scarcely contain his eagerness to proceed. And now that Ella and the other Pecaninos had come, it could begin. The only wall maintaining his isolation now was the disruptor field. Outside it, the Pecaninos, who had gathered to watch his passage, could see all that transpired. They were the only ones who watched in the open, however, perhaps out of a sense of delicacy for Pecanino feelings, or perhaps so they could have a wall between them and the brutality of this Pecanino ritual. The humans had all gathered inside the lab, where only a window and the monitors let them see what would actually happen to Glass. Glass waited until the sterile-suited brothers were in place beside him, wooden knives in hand, before he tore up Capine and chewed it. It was the anesthetic that would make this bearable for him. But it was also the first time that a brother bound for the third life had chewed native grass that contained no Descalada virus within it. If Ella's new virus was right, then the Capine here would work as the Descalada-ruled Capine had always worked.
"If I pass into the third life," said Glass, "the honor belongs to God and to his servant Planter, not to me."
It was fitting that Glass had chosen to use his last words of brother speech to praise Planter, but his graciousness did not change the fact that thinking of Planter's sacrifice caused many among the humans to weep. Hard as it was to interpret Pecanino emotions, Ender had no doubt that the chattering sounds from the Pecaninos gathered outside were also weeping, or some other emotion appropriate to Planter's memory. But Glass was wrong to think that there was no honor for him in this. Everyone knew that failure was still possible, that despite all the cause for hope they had, there was no certainty that Ella's Recolada would have the power to take a brother into the third life. The sterile-suited brothers raised their knives and set to work. "Not me this time," thought Ender. "Thank God I don't have to wield a knife to cause a brother's death." Yet he didn't avert his gaze, as so many others in the lab were doing. The blood and gore were not new to him, and even if that made it no less unpleasant, at least he knew that he could bear it. And what Glass could bear to do, Ender could bear to witness. That was what a speaker for the dead was supposed to do, wasn't it? Witness. He watched as much as he could see of the ritual as they opened up Glass's living body and planted his organs in the earth, so the tree could start to grow while Glass's mind was still alert and alive. Through it all, Glass made no sound or movement that suggested pain. Either his courage was beyond reckoning, or the Recolada had done its work in the Capine grass as well, so that it maintained its anesthetic properties. At last it was done, and the brothers who had taken him into the third life returned to the sterile chamber, where, once their suits were cleansed of the Recolada and viricide bacteria, they shed them and returned naked into the lab. They were very solemn, but Ender thought he could see the excitement and exultation that they concealed. All had gone well. They had felt Glass's body respond to them. Within hours, perhaps minutes, the first leaves of the young tree should arise, and they were sure in their hearts that it would happen. Ender also noticed that one of them was a priest. He wondered what the bishop would say if he knew. Old Peregrino had proved himself to be quite adaptable to assimilating an alien species into the Catholic faith and adapting ritual and doctrine to fit their peculiar needs. But that didn't change the fact that Peregrino was an old man who didn't enjoy the thought of priests taking part in rituals that, despite their clear resemblance to the crucifixion, were still not of the recognized sacraments. Well, these brothers knew what they were doing. Whether they had told the bishop of one of his priests' participation or not, Ender wouldn't mention it, nor would any of the other humans present, if indeed any of them noticed. Yes, the tree was growing, and with great vigor, the leaves visibly rising as they watched. But it would still be many hours, days perhaps, before they knew if it was a father tree, with Glass still alive and conscious within it. A time of waiting, in which Glass's tree must grow in perfect isolation.
If only I could find a place, thought Ender, in which I could also be isolated, in which I could work out the strange things that have happened to me without interference. But he was not a Pecanino, and whatever unease he suffered from was not a virus that could be killed or driven from his life. His disease was at the root of his identity, and he didn't know if he could ever be rid of it without destroying himself in the process. Perhaps, he thought, Peter and Val represent the total of who I am. Perhaps if they were gone, there'd be nothing left. What part of my soul, what action in my life is there that can't be explained as one or the other of them, acting out his or her will within me? Am I the sum of my siblings, or the difference between them? What is the peculiar arithmetic of my soul?
Valentine tried not to be obsessed with this young girl that Ender had brought back with him from outside. Of course, she knew it was her younger self as he remembered her, and she even thought it was rather sweet of him to carry inside his heart such a powerful memory of her at that age. She alone, of all the people on Lusitania, knew why it was at that age that she lingered in his unconscious. He had been in battle school till then, cut off completely from his family. Though he could not have known it, she knew that their parents had pretty much forgotten him. Not forgotten that he existed, of course, but forgotten him as a presence in their lives. He simply wasn't there, wasn't their responsibility anymore. Having given him away to the state, they were absolved. He would have been more a part of their lives if he had died. As it was, they didn't have even a grave to visit. Valentine didn't blame them for this. It proved that they were resilient and adaptable. But she wasn't able to mimic them. Ender was always with her, in her heart. And when, after being inwardly battered, as he was forced to meet all the challenges they threw at him in battle school, Ender now resolved to give up on the whole enterprise, when he in effect went on strike, the officer charged with turning him into a pliant tool came to her, brought her to Ender, gave them time together, the same man who had torn them apart and left such deep wounds in their hearts. She healed her brother then, enough that he could go back and save humanity by destroying the buggers. Of course he holds me in his memory at that age, more powerfully than any of our countless experience together since. Of course, when his unconscious mind brings forth its most intimate baggage, it is the girl I was then who lingers most deeply in his heart. She knew all this. She understood all this. She believed all this. Yet, still it rankled. Still it hurt that this almost mindlessly perfect creature was what he really thought of her all along. That the Valentine that Ender truly loved was a creature of impossible purity. It was for the sake of this imaginary Valentine that he was so close a companion to me all the years before I married Yacht. Unless it was because I married Yacht that he returned to this childish vision of me. Nonsense. There was nothing to be gained by trying to imagine what this young girl meant. Regardless of the manner of her creation, she was here now and must be dealt with. Poor Ender. He seemed to understand nothing. He actually thought at first that he should keep young Val with him. "Isn't she my daughter, after a fashion?" he had asked. "After no fashion is she your daughter," she had answered. "If anything, she's mine, and it is certainly not proper for you to take her into your home alone, especially since Peter is there, and he isn't the most trustworthy co-guardian who ever lived." Ender still didn't fully agree. He would rather have got rid of Peter than Val, but he complied, and since then, Val had lived in Valentine's house. Valentine's intention had been to become the girl's friend and mentor, but in the event, she simply couldn't do it. She wasn't comfortable enough in Val's company. She kept finding reasons to leave home when Val was there. She kept feeling inordinately grateful when Ender came to let her tag along with him and Peter. What finally happened was that, as so often before, Plicht silently stepped in and solved the problem. Plicht became Val's primary companion and guardian in Valentine's house. When Val wasn't with Ender, she was with Plicht. And this morning, Plicht had suggested setting up a house of her own for her and Val. Perhaps I was too hasty in agreeing, thought Valentine. But it's probably as hard on Val to share a house with me as for me to share a house with her. Now, though, watching as Plicht and Val entered the new chapel on their knees and crawled forward, as all the other humans who entered had also crawled, to kiss Bishop Pellegrino's ring before the altar, Valentine realized that she had done nothing for Val's own good, whatever she might have told herself. Val was completely self-contained, unflappable, calm. Why should Valentine imagine that she could make young Val either more or less happy, more or less comfortable? I am irrelevant to this girl-child's life, but she is not irrelevant to mine. She is at once an affirmation and a denial of the most important relationship of my childhood and of much of my adulthood as well. I wish that she had crumbled into nothingness outside, like Miro's old crippled body did. I wish I had never had to face myself like this. And it was herself she was facing. Ella had run that test immediately. Young Val and Valentine were genetically identical. But it makes no sense, Valentine protested. Ender could hardly have memorized my genetic code. There couldn't possibly have been a pattern of that code in the starship with him. Am I supposed to explain it? Asked Ella. Ender had suggested a possibility, that young Val's genetic code was fluid until she and Valentine actually met, and then the phylotes of Val's body had formed themselves into the pattern they found in Valentine's. Valentine kept her own opinion to herself, but she doubted that Ender's guess was right. Young Val had had Valentine's genes from the first moment, because any person who so perfectly fit Ender's vision of Valentine could not have any other genes. The natural law that Jane herself was helping to maintain within the starship would have required it. Or perhaps there was some force that shaped and gave order even to a place of such utter chaos. It hardly mattered, except that however annoyingly perfect and uncomplaining and unlike me this new pseudo-Val might be, Ender's vision of her had been true enough that genetically they were the same. His vision couldn't be much off the mark. Perhaps I really was that perfect then, and only got my rough edges during the years since then. Perhaps I really was that beautiful. Perhaps I really was so young. They knelt before the bishop, Plicht kissed his ring, though she owed no part of the penance of Lusitania. When it came time for young Val to kiss the ring, however, the bishop pulled away his hand and turned away. A priest came forward and told them to go to their seats. "How can I?" said young Val. "I haven't given my penance yet."
"You have no penance," said the priest. "The bishop told me before you came. You weren't here when the sin was committed, so you have no part in the penance."
Young Val looked at him very sadly and said, "I was created by someone other than God. That's why the bishop won't receive me. I'll never have communion while he lives." The priest looked very sad. It was impossible not to feel sorry for young Val, for her simplicity and sweetness made her seem fragile, and the person who hurt her, therefore, had to feel clumsy for having damaged such a tender thing.
"Until the Pope can decide," he said, "all this is very hard."
"I know," whispered young Val. Then she came and sat down between Plicht and Valentine. "Our elbows touch," thought Valentine. "A daughter who is perfectly myself, as if I had cloned her 13 years ago. But I didn't want another daughter, and I certainly didn't want a duplicate of me. She knows that. She feels it.
and so she suffers something that I never suffered. She feels unwanted and unloved by those who are most like her. How does Ender feel about her? Does he also wish that she would go away? Or does he yearn to be her brother, as he was my young brother so many years ago? When I was that age, Ender had not yet committed xenocide. But then, he had not yet spoken for the dead, either. The Hive Queen, the Hegemon, the life of human. All that was beyond him then. He was just a child, confused, despairing, afraid. How could Ender yearn for that time again? Miro soon came in, crawled to the altar, and kissed the ring. Though the bishop had absolved him of any responsibility, he bore the penance with all others. Valentine noticed, of course, the many whispers as he moved forward. Everyone in Lusitania who had known him before his brain damage recognized the miracle that had been performed. A perfect restoration of the Miro who had lived so brightly among them all before. I didn't know you then, Miro, thought Valentine. Did you always have that distant, brooding air? Healed your body, maybe, but you're still the man who lived in pain for this time. Has it made you cold or more compassionate? He came and sat beside her, in the chair that would have been Yacht's, except that Yacht was still in space. With the Descolada soon to be destroyed, someone had to bring to Lusitania's surface the thousands of frozen microbes and plant and animal species that had to be introduced in order to establish a self-regulating geology and keep the planetary systems in order. It was a job that had been done on many other worlds, but it was being made trickier by the need not to compete too intensely with the local species that the Pecaninos depended on. Yacht was up there, laboring for them all. It was a good reason to be gone, but Valentine still missed him. Needed him badly, in fact, what with Ender's new creations causing her such turmoil. Miro was no substitute for her husband, especially because his own new body was such a sharp reminder of what had been done outside. If I went out there, what would I create? I doubt that I'd bring back a person, because I fear there is no one soul at the root of my psyche, not even my own, I fear. What else has my passionate study of history been except a search for humanity? Others find humanity by looking in their own hearts. Only lost souls need to search for it outside themselves. The line's almost done, whispered Miro. Soon the service would begin. Ready to have your sins purged, whispered Valentine. As the bishop explained, he'll purge only the sins of this new body. I still have to confess and do penance for the sins I had left over from the old one. Not many carnal sins were possible, of course, but there's plenty of envy, spite, malice, and self-pity. What I'm trying to decide is whether I also have a suicide to confess. When my old body crumbled into nothing, it was answering the wish of my heart. You should never have got your voice back, said Valentine. You babble now just to hear yourself talk so prettily. He smiled and patted her arm. The bishop began the service with prayer, giving thanks to God for all that had been accomplished in recent months. Conspicuous by omission was the creation of Lusitania's two newest citizens, though Miro's healing was definitely laid at God's door. He called Miro forward and baptized him almost at once, and then, because this was not a mass, the bishop proceeded immediately to his homily. God's mercy has an infinite reach, said the bishop. We can only hope he will choose to reach farther than we deserve, to forgive us for our terrible sins as individuals and as a people. We can only hope that, like Nineveh, which turned away destruction through repentance, we can convince our Lord to spare us from the fleet that he has permitted to come against us to punish us. Miro whispered softly so that only she could hear.
Didn't he send the fleet before the burning of the forest? Maybe the Lord counts only the arrival time, not the departure, Valentine suggested. At once, though, she regretted her flippancy. What was happening here today was a solemn thing. Even if she wasn't a deep believer in Catholic doctrine, she knew that it was a holy thing when a community accepted responsibility for the evil it committed and did true penance for it. The bishop spoke of those who had died in holiness, os venerados, who first saved humanity from the Descolada plague. Father Esteban, whose body was buried under the floor of the chapel, and who suffered martyrdom in the cause of defending truth against heresy. Planter, who died to prove that his people's soul was from God and not from a virus. And the Pecaninos, who had died as innocent victims of slaughter. All of these may be saints someday, for this is a time like the early days of Christianity, when great deeds and great holiness were much more needed and therefore much more often achieved. This chapel is a shrine to all those who have loved their God with all their heart, might, mind, and strength, and who have loved their neighbor as themselves. Let all who enter here do it with a broken heart and a contrite spirit, so that holiness may also touch them. The homily wasn't long, because there were many more identical services scheduled for that day. The people were coming to the chapel in shifts, since it was far too small to accommodate the whole human population of Lusitania all at once. Soon enough, they were done, and Valentine got up to leave. She would have followed close behind Plicht and Val, except that Miro caught at her arm. "Jane just told me," he said. "I thought you'd want to know." "What?" "She just tested the starship without Ender in it." "How could she do that?" asked Valentine. "Peter," he said. "She took him outside and back again. He can contain her Ayua, if that's how this process is actually working." She gave voice to her immediate fear. "Did he create anything?" "No." Miro grinned, but with a hint of the twisted wryness that Valentine had thought was a product of his affliction. "He claims it's because his mind is much clearer and healthier than Andrew's." "Maybe so," said Valentine. "I say it's because none of the Philotes out there were willing to be part of his pattern. Too twisted." Valentine laughed a little. The bishop came up to them then. Since they were among the last to leave, they were alone at the front of the chapel. "Thank you for accepting a new baptism," said the bishop. Miro bowed his head. "Not many men have a chance to be purified so far along in their sins," he said. "And Valentine, I'm sorry I couldn't receive your namesake."
"Don't worry, Bishop Peregrino. I understand. I may even agree with you."
The bishop shook his head.
"It would be better if they could just leave," offered Miro. "You get your wish. Peter will soon be gone. Jane can pilot a ship with him aboard. No doubt the same thing will be possible with young Val."
"No," said Valentine. "She can't go. She's too young?" asked Miro. He seemed amused. "They were both born knowing everything that Ender knows. You can hardly call the girl a child, despite her body."
"If they had been born," said the bishop, "they wouldn't have to leave."
"They're not leaving because of your wish," said Miro.
"They're leaving because Peter's going to deliver Ella's new virus to Path, and young Val's ship is going to go off in search of planets where Pecaninos and Hive Queens can be established."
"You can't send her on such a mission," said Valentine.
"I won't send her," said Miro. "I'll take her. Or rather, she'll take me. I want to go. Whatever risks there are, I'll take them. She'll be safe, Valentine." Valentine still shook her head, but she knew already that in the end she would be defeated. Young Val herself would insist on going, however young she might seem, because if she didn't go, only one starship could travel. And if Peter was the one doing the traveling, There was no telling whether the ship would be used for any good purpose.
In the long run, Valentine herself would bow to the necessity. Whatever danger young Val might be exposed to, it was no worse than the risks already taken by others, like Planter, like Father Esteban, like Glass.
The Pecaninos gathered at Planter's tree. It would have been Glass's tree, since he was the first to pass into the third life with the Recolada, but almost his first words, once they were able to talk with him, were an adamant rejection of the idea of introducing the Viricide and Recolada into the world beside his tree. This occasion belonged to Planter, he declared, and the brothers and wives ultimately agreed with him. So it was that Ender leaned against his friend Human, whom he had planted in order to help him into the third life so many years before. It would have been a moment of complete joy to Ender, the liberation of the Pecaninos from the Descolada, except that he had Peter with him through it all. "Weakness celebrates weakness," said Peter. "Planter failed, and here they are honoring him, while Glass succeeded, and there he stands, alone out there in the experimental field. And the stupidest thing is that it can't possibly mean anything to Planter, since his Iua isn't even here." "It may not mean anything to Planter," said Ender, a point he wasn't altogether sure of anyway, "but it means something to the people here." "Yes," he said, "it means they're weak. Jane says she took you outside." "An easy trip," said Peter. "Next time, though, Lusitania won't be my destination." "She says you plan to take Ella's virus to Path." "My first stop," said Peter. "But I won't be coming back here. Count on that, old boy. We need the ship." "You've got that sweet little slip of a girl," said Peter. "And the bugger bitch can pop out starships for you by the dozen. If only you could spawn enough creatures like me and Valzinia to pilot them." "I'll be glad to see the last of you." "Aren't you curious what I intend to do?" "No," said Ender. But it was a lie, and of course Peter knew it. "I intend to do what you have neither the brains nor the stomach to do. I intend to stop the fleet." "How? Magically appear on the flagship?" "Well, if worse came to worst, dear lad, I could always deliver an MD device to the fleet before they even knew I was there. But that wouldn't accomplish much, would it? To stop the fleet, I need to stop Congress. And to stop Congress, I need to get control." Ender knew at once what this meant. "So you think you can be hegemon again? God help humanity if you succeed." "Why shouldn't I?" said Peter. "I did it once before, and I didn't do it so badly. You should know, you wrote the book yourself." "That was the real Peter," said Ender, "not you, the twisted version conjured up out of my hatred and fear." Did Peter have soul enough to resent these harsh words? Ender thought, for a moment at least, that Peter paused, that his face showed a moment of, what, hurt? Or simply rage. "I'm the real Peter now," he answered, after that momentary pause. "And you'd better hope that I have all the skill I had before. After all, you managed to give Valette the same genes as Valentine. Maybe I'm all that Peter ever was." "Maybe pigs have wings." Peter laughed. "They would if you went outside and believed hard enough." "Go then," said Ender. "Yes, I know you'll be glad to get rid of me. And sick you on the rest of humanity? Let that be punishment enough for their having sent the fleet." Ender gripped Peter by the arm, pulled him close. "Don't think that this time you can maneuver me into helplessness. I'm not a little boy anymore. And if you get out of hand, I'll destroy you." "You can't," said Peter. "You could more easily kill yourself." The ceremony began. This time there was no pomp, no ring to kiss, no homily. Ella and her assistants simply brought several hundred sugar cubes impregnated with the viricide bacterium and as many vials of solution containing the Recolada. They were passed among the congregation, and each of the Pecaninos took the sugar cube, dissolved and swallowed it, and then drank off the contents of the vial. "This is my body, which is given for you," intoned Peter. "This do in remembrance of me." "Have you no respect for anything?" asked Ender.
This is my blood, which I shed for you. Drink in remembrance of me. Peter smiled. This is a communion even I can take, unbaptized as I am.
I can promise you this, said Ender. They haven't invented the baptism yet that can purify you. I'll bet you've been saving up all your life just to say that to me.
Peter turned to him so Ender could see the ear in which the jewel had been implanted, linking him to Jane. In case Ender didn't notice what he was pointing out, Peter touched the jewel rather ostentatiously.
Just remember, I have the source of all wisdom here. She'll show you what I'm doing, if you ever care. If you don't forget me the moment I'm gone.
I won't forget you, said Ender.
You could come along, said Peter.
And risk making more like you outside?
I could use the company.
I promise you, Peter, you'd soon get as sick of yourself as I am sick of you.
Never, said Peter. I'm not filled with self-loathing the way you are, you poor guilt-obsessed tool of better, stronger men. And if you won't make more companions for me, why, I'll find my own along the way.
I have no doubt of it, said Ender. The sugar cubes and vials came to them. They ate, drank.
The taste of freedom, said Peter. Delicious.
Is it? Said Ender.
We're killing a species that we never understood.
I know what you mean, said Peter. It's a lot more fun to destroy an opponent when he's able to understand how thoroughly you defeated him.
Then, at last, Peter walked away.
Ender stayed through the end of the ceremony and spoke to many there. Human and Rooter, of course, and Valentine, Ella, Wanda, and Miro. He had another visit to make, however, a visit he had made several times before, always to be rebuffed, sent away without a word. This time, though, Novenia came out to speak with him, and instead of being filled with rage and grief, she seemed quite calm.
I'm much more at peace, she said, and I know, for what it's worth, that my rage at you was unrighteous.
Ender was glad to hear the sentiment, but surprised at the terms she used. When had Novenia ever spoken of righteousness?
I've come to see that perhaps my boy was fulfilling the purposes of God, she said. That you couldn't have stopped him, because God wanted him to go to the Pecaninos to set in motion the miracles that have come since then. She wept. Miro came to me. Healed, she said. Oh, God is merciful after all, and I'll have King again in heaven when I die.
She's been converted, thought Ender. After all these years of despising the church, of taking part in Catholicism only because there was no other way to be a citizen of Lusitania Colony, these weeks with the children of the mind of Christ have converted her.
I'm glad of it, he thought. She's speaking to me again.
Andrew, she said, I want us to be together again.
He reached out to embrace her, wanting to weep with relief and joy, but she recoiled from his touch.
You don't understand, she said. I won't go home with you. This is my home now.
She was right. He hadn't understood, but now he did. She hadn't just been converted to Catholicism. She had been converted to this order of permanent sacrifice, where only husbands and wives could join, and only together, to take vows of permanent abstinence in the midst of their marriage.
Novenia, he said, I haven't the faith or the strength to be one of the children of the mind of Christ. When you do, she said, I'll be waiting for you here.
Is this the only hope I have of being with you? He whispered.
To forswear loving your body is the only way to have your companionship.
Andrew, she whispered, I long for you. But my sin for so many years was adultery, that my only hope of joy now is to deny the flesh and live in the spirit. I'll do it alone if I must. But with you, oh, Andrew, I miss you.
And I miss you, he thought.
Like breath itself, I miss you, he whispered. But don't ask this of me. Live with me as my wife until the last of our youth is spent, and then when desire is slack, we can come back here together. I could be happy then. Don't you see, she said, I've made a covenant. I've made a promise.
You made one to me, too, he said.
Should I break a vow to God so I can keep my vow with you?
God would understand. How easily those who never hear his voice declare what he would and would not want. Do you hear his voice these days? I hear his song in my heart, the way the psalmist did. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
The 23rd, while the only song I hear is the 22nd.
She smiled wanly. "Why hast thou forsaken me?" she quoted.
"And the part about the bulls of Bashan," said Ender. "I've always felt like I was surrounded by bulls."
She laughed. "Come to me when you can," she said. "I'll be here when you're ready."
She almost left him then.
"Wait."
She waited. "I brought you the viricide and the recolada."
"Alice Triumph," she said. "It was beyond me, you know. I cost you nothing by abandoning my work. My time was past, and she had far surpassed me."
Novenia took the sugar cube, let it melt for a moment, swallowed it. Then she held the vial up against the last light of evening.
"With the red sky, it looks like it's all afire inside."
She drank it, sipped it, really, so that the flavor would linger, even though, as Ender knew, the taste was bitter and lingered unpleasantly in the mouth long afterward.
"Can I visit you?"
"Once a month," she said. Her answer was so quick that he knew she had already considered the question and reached a decision that she had no intention of altering.
"Then once a month I'll visit you," he said.
"Until you're ready to join me," she said.
"Until you're ready to return to me," he answered.
But he knew that she would never bend. Novenia was not a person who could easily change her mind. She had set the bounds of his future. He should have been resentful, angry. He should have blustered about getting his freedom from a marriage to a woman who refused him. But he couldn't think what he might want his freedom for.
"Nothing is in my hands now," he realized. "No part of the future depends on me. My work, such as it is done, and now my only influence on the future is what my children do, such as they are. The monster Peter, the impossibly perfect child Val, and Miro, Grego, Quara, Ella, Olliado, aren't they my children too? Can't I also claim to have helped create them, even if they came from Libo's love and Novenia's body years before I even arrived in this place?"
It was full dark when he found young Val, though he couldn't understand why he was even looking for her. She was in Olliado's house with Plikt, but while Plikt leaned against the shadowed wall, her face inscrutable, young Val was among Olliado's children, playing with them. "Of course she's playing with them," thought Ender. "She's still a child herself, however much experience she might have had thrust upon her out of my memories." But as he stood in the doorway watching, he realized that she wasn't playing equally with all the children. It was Nimbo who really had her attention, the boy who had been burned in more ways than one the night of the mob. The game the children played was simple enough, but it kept them from talking to each other. Still, there was an eloquent conversation between Nimbo and young Val. Her smile toward him was warm, not in the manner of a woman encouraging a lover, but rather as a sister gives her brother the silent message of love, of confidence, of trust. "She's healing him," thought Ender. "Just as Valentine, so many years ago, healed me. Not with words, just with her company. Could I have created her with even that ability intact? Was there that much truth and power in my dream of her? Then maybe Peter also has everything within him that my real brother had, all that was dangerous and terrible, but also that which created a new order." Try as he might, Ender couldn't get himself to believe that story. Young Val might have healing in her eyes, but Peter had none of that in him. His was the face that years before Ender had seen looking back at him from a mirror in the fantasy game, in a terrible room where he died again and again before he could finally embrace the element of Peter within himself and go on. "I embraced Peter and destroyed a whole people. I took him into myself and committed xenocide. I thought, in all these years since then, that I had purged him, that he was gone, but he'll never leave me."
The idea of withdrawing from the world and entering into the order of the children of the mind of Christ, there was much to attract him in that. Perhaps there, Novena and he together could purge themselves of the demons that had dwelt inside them all these years. Novena has never been so much at peace, thought Ender, as she is tonight. Young Val noticed him, came to him as he stood in the doorway. "Why are you here?" she said. "Looking for you," he said. "Plikt and I are spending the night with Olyado's family," she said. She glanced at Nimbo and smiled. The boy grinned foolishly. "Jane says that you're going with the starship," Ender said softly. "If Peter can hold Jane within himself, so can I," she answered. "Miro is going with me, to find habitable worlds." "Only if you want to," said Ender. "Don't be foolish," she said. "Since when have you done only what you want to do? I'll do what must be done. That only I can do." He nodded. "Is that all you came for?" she asked. He nodded again. "I guess," he said. "Or did you come because you wish that you could be the child you were when you last saw a girl with this face?" The words stung. Far worse than when Peter guessed what was in his heart. Her compassion was far more painful than his contempt. She must have seen the expression of pain on his face and misunderstood it. He was relieved that she was capable of misunderstanding. "I do have some privacy left." "Are you ashamed of me?" she asked. "Embarrassed," he said, "to have my unconscious mind made so public, but not ashamed, not of you." He glanced toward Nimbo, then back to her. "Stay here and finish what you started." She smiled slightly. "He's a good boy who thought that he was doing something fine." "Yes," he said, "but it got away from him." "He didn't know what he was doing," she said. "When you don't understand the consequences of your acts, how can you be blamed for them?" He knew that she was talking as much about him, Ender the Xenocide, as about Nimbo. "You don't take the blame," he answered, "but you still take the responsibility for healing the wounds you caused." "Yes," she said, "the wounds you caused, but not all the wounds in the world." "Oh?" he asked. "And why not? Because you plan to heal them all yourself?" She laughed, a light girlish laugh. "You haven't changed a bit, Andrew," she said, "not in all these years." He smiled at her, hugged her lightly, and sent her back into the light of the room. He himself, though, turned back out into the darkness and headed home. There was light enough for him to find his way, yet he stumbled and got lost several times. "You're crying," said Jane in his ear. "This is such a happy day," he said. "It is, you know. You're just about the only person wasting any pity on you tonight." "Fine, then," said Ender. "If I'm the only one, then at least there's one." "You've got me," she said, "and our relationship has been chaste all along." "I've really had enough of chastity in my life," he answered. "I wasn't hoping for more." "Everyone is chaste in the end. Everyone ends up out of the reach of all the deadly sins." "But I'm not dead," he said. "Not yet, or am I?" "Does this feel like heaven?" she asked. He laughed, and not nicely. "Well, then, you can't be dead." "You forget," he said. "This could easily be hell." "Is it?" she asked him. He thought about all that had been accomplished. Ella's viruses, Miro's healing, young Val's kindness to Nimbo, the smile of peace on Novena's face, the Pecaninos rejoicing as their liberty began its passage through the world. Already, he knew, the viricide was cutting an ever-widening swath through the prairie of Caping surrounding the colony. By now it must have already passed into other forests, the Descolada helpless now giving way as the mute and passive Recolada took its place. All these changes couldn't possibly take place in hell. "I guess I'm still alive," he said. "And so am I," she said. "That's something, too. Peter and Val, they're not the only people to spring from your mind." "No, they're not," he said. "We're both still alive, even if we have hard times coming." He remembered what lay in store for her, the mental crippling that was only weeks away, and he was ashamed of himself for having mourned his own losses. "Better to have loved and lost," he murmured, "than never to have loved at all."
It may be a cliché, said Jane, but that doesn't mean it can't be true.
18. The God of Path.
I couldn't taste the changes in the Descolada virus until it was gone.
It was adapting to you?
It was beginning to taste like myself. It had included most of my genetic molecules into its own structure.
Perhaps it was preparing to change you as it changed us.
But when it captured your ancestors, it paired them with the trees they lived in. Whom would we have been paired with?
What other forms of life are there on Lusitania except the ones that are already paired?
Perhaps the Descolada meant to combine us with an existing pair, or replace one pair member with us.
Or perhaps it meant to pair you with the humans.
It's dead now. It will never happen, whatever it planned.
What sort of life would you have led? Mating with human males?
This is disgusting.
Or giving live births, perhaps, in the human manner.
Stop this foulness.
I was merely speculating.
The Descolada is gone. You're free of it.
But never free of what we should have been. I believe that we were sentient before the Descolada came. I believe our history is older than the spacecraft that brought it here. I believe that somewhere in our genes is locked the secret of Pecanino life when we were tree dwellers, rather than the larval stage in the life of sentient trees.
If you had no third life, human, you would be dead now.
Dead now. But while I lived, I could have been not a mere brother, but a father. While I lived, I could have traveled anywhere without worrying about returning to my forest if I ever hoped to mate. Never would I have stood day after day rooted to the same spot, living my life vicariously through the tales the brothers bring to me.
It's not enough for you to be free of the Descolada, then. You must be free of all its consequences, or you won't be content.
I'm always content. I am what I am, no matter how I got that way.
But still not free.
Males and females both. We still have to lose our lives in order to pass on our genes.
Poor fool. Do you think that I, the Hive Queen, am free? Do you think that human parents, once they bear young, are ever truly free again? If life to you means independence, a completely unfettered freedom to do as you like, then none of the sentient creatures is alive. None of us is ever fully free.
Put down roots, my friend, and then tell me how unfree you were when you were yet unrooted.
Wang Mu and Master Han waited together on the riverbank, some 100 meters from their house, a pleasant walk through the garden. Jane had told them that someone would be coming to see them, someone from Lusitania. They both knew this meant that faster-than-light travel had been achieved, but beyond that, they could only assume that their visitor must have come to an orbit around Path, shuttled down, and was now making his way stealthily toward them. Instead, a ridiculously small metal structure appeared on the riverbank in front of them. The door opened. A man emerged. A young man. Large-boned, Caucasian, but pleasant-looking anyway. He held a single glass tube in his hand. He smiled. Wang Mu had never seen such a smile. He looked right through her, as if he owned her soul, as if he knew her better than she knew herself. Wang Mu, he said gently, Royal Mother of the West, and Feidze, the great teacher of the path. He bowed. They bowed to him in return. My business here is brief, he said. He held a vial out to Master Han. Here is the virus. As soon as I've gone, because I have no desire for genetic alteration myself, thank you, drink this down. I imagine it tastes like pus or something equally disgusting, but drink it anyway. Then make contact with as many people as possible, in your house and the town nearby. You'll have about 6 hours before you start feeling sick. With any luck, at the end of the second day, you'll have not a single symptom left. Of anything. He grinned. No more little air dances for you, Master Han, eh? No more servility for any of us, said Han Feidze. We're ready to release our messages at once. Don't spring this on anybody until you've already spread the infection for a few hours. Of course, said Master Han. Your wisdom teaches me to be careful, though my heart tells me to hurry and proclaim the glorious revolution that this merciful plague will bring to us. Yes, very nice, said the man. Then he turned to Wang Mu. But you don't need the virus, do you? No, sir, said Wang Mu. Jane says you're as bright a human being as she's ever seen. Jane is too generous, said Wang Mu. No, she showed me the data. He looked her up and down. She didn't like the way his eyes took possession of her whole body in that single long glance. You don't need to be here for the plague. In fact, you'd be better off leaving before it happens.
Leaving?
What is there for you here? Asked the man. I don't care how revolutionary it gets here. You'll still be a servant and the child of low-class parents. In a place like this, you could spend your whole life overcoming it, and you'd still be nothing but a servant with a surprisingly good mind. Come with me, and you'll be part of changing history. Making history.
Come with you and do what?
Overthrow Congress, of course. Cut them off at the knees and send them all crawling back home. Make all the colony worlds equal members of the polity, clean out the corruption, expose all the vile secrets, and call home the Lusitania fleet before it can commit an atrocity. Establish the rights of all Raman races. Peace and freedom.
And you intend to do all this?
Not alone, he said.
She was relieved.
I'll have you.
To do what?
To write, to speak, to do whatever I need you to do.
But I'm uneducated, sir. Master Han was only beginning to teach me.
Who are you? Demanded Master Han. How can you expect a modest girl like this to pick up and go with a stranger? A modest girl? Who gives her body to the foreman in order to get a chance to be close to a God-spoken girl who might just hire her to be a secret maid? No, Master Han. She may be putting on the attitudes of a modest girl, but that's because she's a chameleon. Changing hides whenever she thinks it'll get her something.
I'm not a liar, sir, she said.
No, I'm sure you sincerely become whatever it is you're pretending to be. So now I'm saying, pretend to be a revolutionary with me. You hate the bastards who did all this to your world. To Qinzhao.
How do you know so much about me? He tapped his ear. For the first time she noticed the jewel there.
Jane keeps me informed about the people I need to know.
Jane will die soon, said Wang Mu.
Oh, she may get semi-stupid for a while, said the man. But die she will not. You helped save her, and in the meantime, I'll have you.
I can't, she said. I'm afraid.
All right, then, he said. I offered.
He turned back to the door of his tiny craft. Wait, she said. He faced her again. Can't you at least tell me who you are?
Peter Wiggin is my name, he said. Though I imagine I'll use a false one for a while.
Peter Wiggin, she whispered. That's the name of the...
My name. I'll explain it to you later, if I feel like it. Let's just say that Andrew Wiggin sent me. Sent me off rather forcefully. I'm a man with a mission, and he figured I could only accomplish it on one of the worlds where Congress's power structures are most heavily concentrated. I was hegemon once, Wang Wu, and I intend to have the job back, whatever the title might turn out to be when I get it. I'm going to break a lot of eggs and cause an amazing amount of trouble and turn this whole 100 worlds thing arse over tea kettle, and I'm inviting you to help me. But I really don't give a damn whether you do or not, because even though it'd be nice to have your brains and your company, I'll do the job one way or another. So are you coming, or what?
She turned to Master Han in an agony of indecision.
I had been hoping to teach you, said Master Han. But if this man is going to work toward what he says he will, then with him you'll have a better chance to change the course of human history than you'd ever have here, where the virus will do our main work for us.
Wang Mu whispered to him, leaving you will be like losing a father.
And if you go, I will have lost my second and last daughter. Don't break my heart, you two, said Peter. I've got a faster-than-light starship here. Leaving Path with me isn't a lifetime thing, you know. If things don't work out, I can always bring her back in a day or two. Fair enough.
You want to go. I know it, said Master Han. Don't you also know that I want to stay as well?
I know that too, said Master Han. But you will go.
Yes, she said. I will.
May the gods watch over you, daughter Wang Mu, said Master Han.
And may every direction be the east of sunrise to you, Father Han. Then she stepped forward. The young man named Peter took her by the hand and led her into the starship. The door closed behind them. A moment later, the starship disappeared.
Master Han waited there 10 minutes, meditating until he could compose his feelings. Then he opened the vial, drank its contents, and walked briskly back to the house. Old Mu Bao greeted him just inside the door.
Master Han, she said, I didn't know where you had gone, and Wang Mu is missing too.
She'll be gone for a while, he said. Then he walked very close to the old servant so that his breath would be in her face. You have been more faithful to my house than we have ever deserved. A look of fear came upon her face.
Master Han, you're not dismissing me, are you?
No, he said. I thought that I was thanking you. He left Mu Bao and ranged through the house. Ching Zhao was not in her room. That was not a surprise. She spent most of her time entertaining visitors. That would suit his purpose well. And indeed, that was where he found her, in the morning room, with 3 very distinguished old God-spoken men from a town 200 kilometers away. Ching Zhao introduced them graciously, and then adopted the role of submissive daughter in her father's presence. He bowed to each man, but then found occasion to reach out his hand and touch each one of them. Jane had explained that the virus was highly communicable. Mere physical closeness was usually enough. Touching made it more sure. And when they were greeted, he turned to his daughter. Ching Zhao, he said, will you have a gift from me? She bowed and answered graciously, whatever my father has brought me, I will gratefully receive, though I know I am not worthy of his notice. He reached out his arms and drew her into him. She was stiff and awkward in his embrace. He had not done such an impulsive thing before dignitaries since she was a very little girl. But he held her all the same, tightly, for he knew that she would never forgive him for what came from this embrace, and therefore it would be the last time he held his gloriously bright within his arms.
Ching Zhao knew what her father's embrace meant. She had watched her father walking in the garden with Wang Mu. She had seen the walnut-shaped starship appear on the riverbank. She had seen him take the vial from the round-eyed stranger. She saw him drink. Then she came here, to this room, to receive visitors on her father's behalf. I am dutiful, my honored father, even when you prepare to betray me. And even now, knowing that his embrace was his cruelest effort to cut her off from the voice of the gods, knowing that he had so little respect for her that he thought he could deceive her, she nevertheless received whatever he determined to give her. Was he not her father? His virus from the world of Lusitania might or might not steal the voice of the gods from her. She could not guess what the gods would permit their enemies to do, but certainly, if she rejected her father and disobeyed him, the gods would punish her. Better to remain worthy of the gods by showing proper respect and obedience to her father than to disobey him in the name of the gods and thereby make herself unworthy of their gifts. So she received his embrace and breathed deeply of his breath. When he had spoken briefly to his guests, he left. They took his visit with them as a signal honor. So faithfully had Ching Zhao concealed her father's mad rebellion against the gods that Han Feitza was still regarded as the greatest man of path. She spoke to them softly and smiled graciously and saw them on their way. She gave them no hint that they would carry away with them a weapon. Why should she? Human weapons would be of no use against the power of the gods unless the gods willed it. And if the gods wished to stop speaking to the people of Path, then this might well be the disguise they had chosen for their act. Let it seem to the unbeliever that Father's Lusitanian virus cuts us off from the gods. I will know, as will all other faithful men and women, that the gods speak to whomever they wish, and nothing made by human hands could stop them if they so desired. All their acts were vanity. If Congress believed that they had caused the gods to speak on Path, let them believe it. If Father and the Lusitanians believe that they are causing the gods to fall silent, let them believe it. I know that if I am only worthy of it, the gods will speak to me. A few hours later, Ching Zhao fell deathly ill. The fever struck her like a blow from a strong man's hand. She collapsed and barely noticed as servants carried her to her bed. The doctors came, though she could have told them there was nothing they could do, and that by coming they would only expose themselves to infection. But she said nothing, because her body was struggling too fiercely against the disease, or rather, her body was struggling to reject her own tissues and organs until at last the transformation of her genes was complete. Even then, it took time for her body to purge itself of the old antibodies. She slept and slept. It was bright afternoon when she awoke. Time, she croaked, and the computer in her room spoke the hour and day. The fever had taken 2 days from her life. She was on fire with thirst. She got to her feet and staggered to her bathroom, turned on the water, filled the cup and drank until she was satisfied. It made her giddy to stand upright. Her mouth tasted foul. Where were the servants who should have given her food and drink during her disease? They must be sick as well. And Father, he would have fallen ill before me. Who will bring him water? She found him sleeping, cold with last night's sweat, trembling. She woke him with a cup of water, which he drank eagerly, his eyes looking upward into hers, questioning, or perhaps pleading for forgiveness. Do your penance to the gods, Father. You owe no apologies to a mere daughter. Ching Zhao also found the servants, one by one, some of them so loyal that they had not taken to their beds with their sickness, but rather had fallen where their duties required them to be. All were alive. All were recovering, and soon would be up again. Only after all were accounted for and tended to did Ching Zhao go to the kitchen and find something to eat. She could not hold down the first food she took. Only a thin soup, heated to lukewarm, stayed with her. She carried more of the soup to the others. They also ate. Soon all were up again and strong. Ching Zhao took servants with her and carried water and soup to all the neighboring houses, rich and poor alike. All were grateful to receive what they brought, and many uttered prayers on their behalf. You would not be so grateful, thought Ching Zhao, if you knew that the disease you suffered came from my father's house, by my father's will. But she said nothing. In all this time, the gods did not demand any purification of her. At last, she thought, at last I am pleasing them. At last I have done perfectly all that righteousness required. When she came home, she wanted to sleep at once. But the servants who had remained in the house were gathered around the hollow in the kitchen, watching news reports. Ching Zhao almost never watched the hollow news, getting all her information from the computer, but the servants looked so serious, so worried, that she entered the kitchen and stood in their circle around the hollow vision. The news was of the plague sweeping the world of Path. Quarantine had been ineffective, or else always came too late. The woman reading the report had already recovered from the disease, and she was telling that the plague had killed almost no one, though it disrupted services for many. The virus had been isolated, but it died too quickly to be studied seriously. It seems that a bacterium is following the virus, killing it almost as soon as each person recovers from the plague. The gods have truly favored us to send us the cure along with the plague. Fools, thought Jing Zhao. If the gods wanted you cured, they wouldn't have sent the plague in the first place. At once, she realized that she was the fool. Of course the gods could send both the disease and the cure. If a disease came and the cure followed, then the gods had sent them. How could she have called such a thing foolish? It was as if she had insulted the gods themselves. She flinched inwardly, waiting for the onslaught of the gods' rage. She had gone so many hours without purification that she knew it would be a heavy burden when it came. Would she have to trace a whole room again? But she felt nothing. No desire to trace wood grain lines, no need to wash. She looked at her hands. There was dirt on them, and yet she didn't care. She could wash them or not, as she desired. For a moment, she felt immense relief. Could it be that Father and Wang Mu and the Jane thing were right all along? Had a genetic change caused by this plague freed her at last from a hideous crime committed by Congress centuries ago? Almost as if the newsreader had heard Ching Zhao's thoughts, she began reading a report about a document that was turning up on computers all over the world. The document said that this plague was a gift from the gods, freeing the people of Path from a genetic alteration performed on them by Congress. Until now, genetic enhancements were almost always linked to an OCD-like condition whose victims were commonly referred to as God-spoken. But as the plague ran its course, people would find that the genetic enhancements were now spread to all the people of Path, while the God-spoken, who had previously borne the most terrible of burdens, had now been released by the gods from the necessity of constant purification. This document says that the whole world is now purified. The gods have accepted us. The newsreader's voice trembled as she spoke. It is not known where this document came from. Computer analysis has linked it with no known author's style. The fact that it turned up simultaneously on millions of computers suggests that it came from a source with unspeakable powers. She hesitated, and now her trembling was plainly visible. If this unworthy reader of news may ask a question, hoping that the wise will hear it and answer her with wisdom, could it not be possible that the gods themselves have sent us this message so that we will understand their great gift to the people of Path? Ching Zhao listened for a while longer as fury grew within her. It was Jane, obviously, who had written and spread this document. How dare she pretend to know what the gods were doing? She had gone too far. This document must be refuted. Jane must stand revealed, and also the whole conspiracy of the people of Lusitania. The servants were looking at her. She met their gaze, looking for a moment at each of them around the circle. "What do you want to ask me?" she said.
"Oh, mistress," said Mu Bao, "forgive our curiosity, but this news report has declared something that we can only believe if you tell us that it is true."
"What do I know?" answered Qing Zhao. "I am only the foolish daughter of a great man."
"But you are one of the godspoken, mistress," said Mu Bao.
"You are very daring," thought Qing Zhao, "to speak of such things unbidden. In all this night, since you came among us with food and drink, and as you led so many of us out among the people, tending the sick, you have never once excused yourself for purification. We have never seen you go so long."
"Did it not occur to you," said Qing Zhao, "that perhaps we were so well fulfilling the will of the gods that I had no need of purification during that time?"
Mu Bao looked abashed. "No, we did not think of that."
"Rest now," said Qing Zhao. "None of us is strong yet. I must go and speak to my father."
She left them to gossip and speculate among themselves. Father was in his room, seated before the computer. Jane's face was in the display. Father turned to her as soon as she entered the room. His face was radiant, triumphant.
"Did you see the message that Jane and I prepared?" he said.
"You!" cried Qing Zhao. "My father, a teller of lies!" To say such a thing to her father was unthinkable, but still she felt no need to purify herself. It frightened her that she could speak with such disrespect, and yet the gods did not rebuke her.
"Lies," said Father. "Why do you think that they are lies, my daughter? How do you know that the gods did not cause this virus to come to us? How do you know that it is not their will to give these genetic enhancements to all of Path?"
His words maddened her. Or perhaps she felt a new freedom, or perhaps she was testing the gods by speaking very disrespectfully so that they would have to rebuke her.
"Do you think I am a fool?" shouted Qing Zhao. "Do you think that I don't know this is your strategy to keep the world of Path from erupting in revolution and slaughter? Do you think I don't know that all you care about is keeping people from dying?"
"And is there something wrong with that?" asked Father.
"It is a lie," she answered.
"Or it's the disguise the gods have prepared to conceal their actions," said Father. "You had no trouble accepting Congress's stories as true. Why can't you accept mine?"
"Because I know about the virus, Father. I saw you take it from that stranger's hand. I saw Wang Mu step into his vehicle. I saw it disappear. I know that none of these things are of the gods. She did them, that devil that lives in the computers."
"How do you know," said Father, "that she is not one of the gods?" This was unbearable.
"She was made," cried Qing Zhao. "That's how I know. She's only a computer program made by human beings, living in machines that human beings made. The gods are not made by any hand. The gods have always lived and will always live."
For the first time, Jane spoke. "Then you are a god, Qing Zhao, and so am I, and so is every other person, human or Raman, in the universe. No god made your soul, your inmost Ayua. You are as old as any god and as young, and you will live as long." Qing Zhao screamed. She had never made such a sound before that she remembered. It tore at her throat.
"My daughter," said Father,
coming toward her, his arms outstretched to embrace her. She could not bear his embrace. She could not endure it because it would mean his complete victory. It would mean that she had been defeated by the enemies of the gods. It would mean that Jane had overmastered her. It would mean that Wang Mu had been a truer daughter to Han Feitsa than Qing Zhao had been. It would mean that all Ching Zhao's worship for all these years had meant nothing. It would mean that it was evil of her to set in motion the destruction of Jane. It would mean that Jane was noble and good for having helped transform the people of Path. It would mean that Mother was not waiting for her when at last she came to the Infinite West. "Why don't you speak to me, O gods?" she cried out silently. "Why don't you assure me that I have not served you in vain all these years? Why have you deserted me now and given the triumph to your enemies?" And then the answer came to her, as simply and clearly as if her mother had whispered the words in her ear, "This is a test, Ching Zhao. The gods are watching what you do." A test? Of course. The gods were testing all their servants on Path to see which ones were deceived and which endured in perfect obedience. If I am being tested, then there must be some correct thing for me to do. I must do what I have always done. Only this time, I must not wait for the gods to instruct me. They have wearied of telling me every day and every hour when I needed to be purified. It is time for me to understand my own impurity without their instructions. I must purify myself with utter perfection. Then I will have passed the test, and the gods will receive me once again. She dropped to her knees. She found a wood grain line and began to trace it. There was no answering gift of release, no sense of rightness, but that did not trouble her, because she understood that this was part of the test. If the gods answered her immediately, the way they used to, then how would it be a test of her dedication? Where before she had undergone her purification under their constant guidance, now she must purify herself alone. And how would she know if she had done it properly? The gods would come to her again. The gods would speak to her again. Or perhaps they would carry her away, take her to the palace of the royal mother, where the noble Han Chengqing awaited her. There she would also meet Li Qingzhao, her ancestor of the heart. There her ancestors would all greet her, and they would say, "The gods determined to try all the gods spoken of Path. Few indeed have passed this test, but you, Qingzhao, you have brought great honor to us all, because your faithfulness never wavered. You performed your purifications as no other son or daughter has ever performed them. The ancestors of other men and women are all envious of us. For your sake, the gods now favor us above them all." "What are you doing?" asked Father. "Why are you tracing the wood grain lines?" She did not answer. She refused to be distracted. "The need for that has been taken away. I know it has. I feel no need for purification." "Ah, Father, if only you could understand. But even though you will fail this test, I will pass it, and thus I will bring honor even to you who have forsaken all honorable things." "Ching Zhao," he said, "I know what you're doing. Like those parents who force their mediocre children to wash and wash, you're calling the gods." "Give it that name if you wish, Father. Your words are nothing to me now. I will not listen to you again until we are both dead, and you say to me, 'My daughter, you were better and wiser than I. All my honor here in the house of the royal mother comes from your purity and selfless devotion to the service of the gods. You are truly a noble daughter. I have no joy except because of you.'"
The world of Path accomplished its transformation peacefully. Here and there, a murder occurred. Here and there, one of the Godspoken, who had been tyrannical, was mobbed and cast out of his house. But by and large, the story given by the document was believed, and the former Godspoken were treated with great honor because of their righteous sacrifice during the years when they were burdened with the rites of purification. Still, the old order quickly passed away. The schools were opened equally to all children. Teachers soon reported that students were achieving remarkable things. The stupidest child now was surpassing all averages from former times. And despite Congress's outraged denials of any genetic alteration, scientists on PATH at last turned their attention to the genes of their own people. Studying the records of what their genetic molecules had been and how they were now, the women and men of PATH confirmed all that the document had said. What happened then, as the Hundred Worlds and all the colonies learned of Congress's crimes against PATH, Ching Zhao never knew of it. That was all a matter for a world that she had left behind, for she spent all her days now in the service of the gods, cleansing herself, purifying herself. The story spread that Hanfeize's mad daughter, alone of all the godspoken, persisted in her rituals. At first, she was ridiculed for it, for many of the godspoken had, out of curiosity, attempted to perform their purifications again and had discovered the rituals to be empty and meaningless now. But she heard little of the ridicule and cared nothing for it. Her mind was devoted solely to the service of the gods. What did it matter if the people who had failed the test despised her for continuing to attempt to succeed? As the years passed, many began to remember the old days as a graceful time when the gods spoke to men and women, and many were bowed down in their service. Some of these began to think of Ching Zhao not as a madwoman, but as the only faithful woman left among those who had heard the voice of the gods. The word began to spread among the pious. In the house of Hanfeize, there dwells the last of the godspoken. They began to come then, at first a few, then more and more of them, visitors who wanted to speak with the only woman who still labored in her purification. At first, she would speak to some of them. When she had finished tracing a board, she would go out into the garden and speak to them. But their words confused her. They spoke of her labor as being the purification of the whole planet. They said that she was calling the gods for the sake of all the people of PATH. The more they talked, the harder it was for her to concentrate on what they said. She was soon eager to return to the house to begin tracing another line. Didn't these people understand that they were wrong to praise her now? I have accomplished nothing, she would tell them. The gods are still silent. I have work to do. And then she would return to her tracing. Her father died as a very old man, with much honor for his many deeds, though no one ever knew his role in the coming of the plague of the gods, as it was now called. Only Ching Zhao understood. And as she burned a fortune in real money, no false funeral money would do for her father, she whispered to him so that no one else could hear. Now you know, father. Now you understand your errors and how you angered the gods. But don't be afraid. I will continue the purification until all your mistakes are rectified. Then the gods will receive you with honor. She herself became old, and the journey to the house of Han Ching Zhao was now the most famous pilgrimage of PATH. Indeed, there were many who heard of her on other worlds and came to PATH just to see her, for it was well known on many worlds that true holiness could be found in only one place and in only one person, the old woman whose back was now permanently bent, whose eyes could now see nothing but the lines in the floors of her father's house. Holy disciples, men and women, now tended the house where servants had once cared for her. They polished the floors. They prepared her simple food and laid it where she could find it at the doors of the rooms. She would eat and drink only when a room was finished. When a man or woman somewhere in the world achieved some great honor, they would come to the house of Han Ching Zhao, kneel down, and trace a wood grain line. Thus, all honors were treated as if they were mere decorations on the honor of the holy Han Ching Zhao. At last, only a few weeks after she completed her 100th year, Han Ching Zhao was found curled up on the floor of her father's room. Some said that it was the exact spot where her father always sat when he performed his labors. It was hard to be sure, since all the furniture of the house had been removed long before. The holy woman was not dead when they found her. She lay still for several days, murmuring, muttering,
inching her hands across her own body as if she were tracing lines in her flesh. Her disciples took turns, 10 at a time, listening to her, trying to understand her muttering, setting down the words as best they understood them. They were written in the book called The God Whispers of Han Qingzhao. Most important of all her words were these at the very end. Mother, she whispered, Father, did I do it right? And then, said her disciples, she smiled and died. She had not been dead for a month before the decision was made in every temple and shrine, in every city and town and village of Path. At last, there was a person of such surpassing holiness that Path could choose her as the protector and guardian of the world. No other world had such a god, and they admitted it freely. Path is blessed above all other worlds, they said, for the god of Path is gloriously bright.
Xenocide did not begin as a book about Ender Wiggin. The story originated as a project called Phylotes, which I thought of as a way of expressing some, I thought, interesting ideas about physics and what might be outside the realm of organized existence. I submitted an outline for that book to an editor, Jim Frankel, shortly after my third novel, I believe, was purchased. So it was very early in my career. And he wrote back and said, "This is a wonderful idea, but you're not ready to write it yet." And he was right. Though I didn't enjoy hearing that, I realized that in order to make a story as complicated as this and as philosophical and talky as it was bound to be, in order to make it work, I had to be a much better writer than I was at the time. Whether by the time I wrote Xenocide I had become a good enough writer, I don't know. But what happened was I was in the midst of writing Speaker for the Dead when my agent called me and said, "Scott, good news, I've sold the Ender trilogy in England." And I answered, "Well, see, Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead, don't they usually require that a trilogy have three books?" And she was nonplussed for a moment and then said, "Well, can't you think of another?" And at that moment, on the telephone with her, it occurred to me that that old project, Phylotes, could easily become a much better, more interesting story if it were Ender Wiggin who took the trip outside. So I reconstructed the story of Phylotes and added Ender and obviously Valentine and Peter to the mix, and it became an expression of his character. In the meantime, I was able to continue issues that I had left unresolved in Speaker for the Dead, and the result is the book that you have just heard. Unfortunately, as I was in the midst of writing Xenocide, I realized that this book was way bigger than I had ever anticipated. And so along about 110,000 words, when it was clear that my outline was going to result in a 300,000-word novel, I called my publisher and said, "What if we split Xenocide into two books?" And the publisher agreed that that was an excellent idea because publishers have a way of appreciating the opportunity to sell the same book for twice the price, which is in effect what you do when you split a book in half. I sound cynical, but of course it doesn't hurt the author either. But in truth, Xenocide being so focused on the story of Gloriously Bright and having this dividing point where Ender goes outside and is able to reconstruct Peter and Valentine, I realized that that was the perfect dividing point for the novel. And Children of the Mind, the second half, would then have virtually nothing about Gloriously Bright and focus instead on the relationship between Ender and these new people that he had created. It was a different book. So I tried to wrap up Xenocide in a satisfying way. I've been told by some that I did not succeed as well as I'd hoped. So I hope that instead of despairing and feeling cheated by the fact that this book doesn't fully end, you'll instead be inexorably drawn to Children of the Mind and find that one an irresistible read. That's what authors always hope, that there will be an audience that cares about and believes in the story as much as the author does himself.
Xenocide by Orson Scott Card, read by Scott Brick, Jennifer Castle, Gabrielle DeCure,
Amanda Carr, John Rubinstein, Stefan Rudnicki, and Orson Scott Card, with an original afterword by the author. Directed by Stefan Rudnicki and Gabrielle DeCure, produced by Stefan Rudnicki. Copyright 2003, Fantastic Audio.